Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
Hello and welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. My name is Dr. Mark McNear and I will be your guest host today, filling in for my good friend Monique Coven. Today, I am excited, filled with gratitude over my guest, Dr. Dan Allender. Dan, welcome once again to the Healing Trauma Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, Dan. We had talked earlier about talking about story work or narrative-focused trauma care, and I thought I would start with a story, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
And that is, so I got out of rehab about 10 and a half years ago after very, very severe abuse. And one of the things that was recommended to me was your book, Healing the Wounded Heart. I had lived like 55 years of my life, did not realize that I had been sexually abused severely by my dad. And so the addictions and things like that were covering up the pain. And in following you and finding some of the people that you had worked with, I signed up for an intensive and we did story work. And to be honest with you, it was so scary to step into that arena and to be like, I think I should do this, but being scared to death and just feeling my body like all over the place. I want to just share this with you and have you take the stage from there. We spent many hours talking about the details of the abuse and some of the addictions that came as a result of the abuse, ways that I coped. I can remember, and I was thinking about this morning, getting ready for our podcast, that I remember after the 3 days and the hours of talking about things, I walked down to the mailbox and I never felt as light or as happy or as free. It was like this whole world opened up to me that I had never, ever experienced before. I want our listeners to be able to get the information from you today about narrative-focused trauma care, how it came about, what you do in it, because I think that the human mind, at least mine, I tend to complicate things a lot. For me, it was really hard to do, but really easy to do. And the results were incredible. I'm going to hand it over to you.
Well, first and foremost, thank you. And again, it is such a courageous, but also honoring of your own story to be able to name that there was a haunting that may not have been conscious, may not have been in the forefront of your mind and your heart, but something in your body knew that, and using a phrase from Romans chapter 1, that you were suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. And that's a lovely but difficult phrase for most of us who know trauma, because in some way it's our survival. It doesn't feel like failure. It feels like we're doing the very best we can to make it through a day or through a month. But the reality is, every time we hide, every time we suppress the truth about anything, about the nature of life, the nature of our life and our story, there's a consequence. And it's, to me, it's almost like the image of, if you've ever tried to hold like a beach ball underneath a pool, underneath water, it's exhausting. It requires incredible balance to be able to keep that truth underneath the water. It just wants to come up. And I think that's one of the good news with regard to our story. Our body, our very being knows that we are trying to escape for survival, things that seem like if we enter it, it will kill us. And yet, I love that. I love what you have brought, and that is that there was, in the engagement with the particularity of story, just a new freedom and a new joy. And I think that's why we do this work, why we want people to do this work. We want joy. And I'm so grateful that you encountered, discovered, but also received that. So that would be the beginning. And that is, anyone who's paying the price of trying to keep the ball of truth under the water is going to be exhausted. And it's going to show in some degree of a loss of our humanity, a loss of freedom and choice and power. And every addiction, no matter what it is, will be a form of deprivation. That is, it gives some sense of life, but in it, it steals, it kills, it destroys life. And grateful that you have come to the surface regarding your own story and something of the goodness of God. So that's the beginning. Let's just start with a clear premise. How did you engage those stories? I know you're the interviewer, but I'm just curious how the process was for you.
The first thing I would say to you was that I was very, very resistant to doing it. In rehab, I had taken a lot of medication and had stuffed down abuse from the age of 4 with my dad till the age of 7. And so I am sitting there in rehab and just pondering, thinking, obsessing, if you will. These memories are coming up, these pictures are coming up. And at the same time, I'm saying to myself, there's no way I'm going to talk about these. And at the same time, needing to talk about them. And so with the help of different individuals, and one was, I just want to share this with you. One was a really good friend that I made in rehab, and he was safe. And so I was able to share with him just a tiny, tiny bit of my story. As fragmented as it was, as confusing as it was met with a lot of kindness and a lot of openness. And he said to me, you know what, this seems overwhelming and you're not going to be able to maybe do it here, but I'm going to encourage you when you get out of here to find somebody. And that's what I needed to hear. I didn't need to be pushed, that's for sure, but I also needed an invitation. And so through different things, different programs, I began to work and just share little pieces, like just little things. And I was talking the other day about this, just dipping my toe in the water. As I did that, there was just like from a theoretical view, I would say just a little bit less fragmentation. From a lay point of view, there was just a little bit less craziness going on, running around in my head. And so working with different people and then getting your book and then beginning to read Unwanted and signing up for several intensives. That's how it really began as far as story work.
It's so beautiful. If I can borrow what you have said, that to me, the first category is someone honored your story. And in that, they weren't trying to resolve it. And I think there are just so many good-hearted people who feel the necessity in stories of trauma and tragedy to feel like they've got to wrap it up, kind of come to a conclusion. And in that, I'm not saying the impulse is not human, but it's a failure. The story is not being honored in its complexity, in its depth, in its necessity to be engaged. And to me, the next word is slowly. Honor does not mean resolve. It means that slow process. Like decades ago, I ran a half marathon and I remember buying the gear and thinking, I am going to go try and run. Well, I did maybe a mile and I was hurting. Half marathon, I think it was what, about 13.2 miles. I wasn't ready, but slowly. Training over a long season gave me access to be able, as an older man, to run the half marathon in a way that was, back to the word, honoring. And so being faithful with the small, you know, many times we come to a story of trauma or abuse and we want to get it over. We want to get it done. And so we throw ourselves into the deep end. And people will often say to me, particularly in therapy, I've tried to do this work and it was disastrous. And asking, in one sense, metaphorically, did you buy the gear and try to run a marathon? And for most people, the answer is, well, yeah, I wanted to get it done. Well, you just know only too well. You have to let yourself slowly honor in short seasons the experience of dealing with what you're dealing. But the key word for me was when you use the word kindness. We have a passage in Romans chapter 2, verse 4, and that is, it is the kindness of God that leads to repentance. Now, clearly, let me just say it bluntly, an abuse victim has nothing to repent of with regard to having been harmed. Nothing with regard to what they felt in the process of being abused. But the reality is all of us turned ultimately to ourselves to resolve this. That's what I meant by we suppress the truth. So the ways by which you suppress the truth, for decades, I suppressed the truth by alcohol, drugs. I also suppress the truth by reading. I know that's a strange interplay, but you can find ways to dissociate that might be chemical, but you also have the potential of finding other ways that allow you a more societally approved means. And so I've got, I don't, haven't counted it, but 11 or 12 years of graduate work. Well, yeah, but how come? Part of that was it was all done in something of a dissociative fog because the academic world provides an incredible means of escaping certain forms of reality. So when we begin to honor, when we allow ourselves slow engagement with the small, but when kindness begins to grow through the care of another, as it was with regard to that person in rehab with you, but also where we begin to grow in kindness for our own story and allow the kindness of God to open the door to what the word repentance implies. And that is a return to goodness, a return to what brings life rather than decay and death. So I think as we step into this, it's just so important to underline that abuse always brings this sense of betrayal. And it's huge. You were, in some sense, set up by your father. And every abuser sets the victim up for some level of trust. But even in that, there is this profound betrayal that I was groomed by those who abused me by some offer of what it was that I missed in the context of my family of origin. So we know abuse never happens in a vacuum. There's always a context. The abuser is reading you, reading your needs, reading, in some sense, your God-given desire, and utilizing that to gain access, loyalty, relationship. So that's all the damage of abuse, which it isn't. It's enough. But when you go to the next level of powerlessness, that sense of the abuser was big and you were not. And in that sense of every regard, like intellectually, financially, reputationally, physically, they're big, we're not. That subjects us to a level of we had no control, we had no power to stop whatever we were enduring. And that experience of powerlessness creates the same fragmentation you are naming. You know, we were betrayed, we're fragmented, we feel powerless. Were fragmented. But then you add this third dimension, and it's one of the hardest to speak about, and certainly the hardest to hear. We talked a little bit about betrayal and that it fragments. We've talked a little bit about powerlessness and that it equally fragments. But when trust is broken, really evil is working to destroy our capacity for faith. And when we feel powerless, we really do lose something of a sense of hope. But I think the real work that evil wants to perpetrate is to ruin our capacity to love, to receive, and to give. And something of the pleasure of communal care and honor. And that's what evil's working ultimately to occur, bring about. And that is when our body is touched, be it our hair, be it our face, literally, there will be a rise of oxytocin, that is our bonding biochemical, or dopamine, our pleasure biochemical. Imagine if that's true with regard to somebody tussling your hair, touching your face, how much more so there's going to be the experience of dopamine if your vagina or your penis is touched. And there are more nerve endings than any other part of our body other than our taste buds. So the reality is, even if you hate it, even if you were terrified of what was occurring, your body will feel like it betrays you by experiencing a degree of pleasure. And that's where the fundamental sense of shame, there is something ugly, toxic, dangerous arc, something stained and ruined about me. And that is what needs to be hidden, hidden from others and hidden from ourselves. And so when we talked earlier about suppressing the truth, what's the truth that we are so afraid to engage? And I think at some level, it is that something in me came alive when I was abused, that I also feel tortured, violated, hated, used. Yes, but that's the word ambivalence. How do I bear this insanity, craziness of feeling alive, but also feeling dead, feeling pleasure, but feeling horror all simultaneously? And if you're a four-year-old, as you were, how do you have language for that? It's hard enough when I work with adults who are 30, 40, 50, or above to allow themselves in their body to come to language of what occurred in their story. How much more so for a four-year-old, eight-year-old, 12-year-old? The answer is we don't have that capacity to be able to do so. And that's why it is so tragic that that remnant of shame lives within us for decades, often suffused in our own addictive processes, that it takes, shall we say, a heartbreaking, long process to come to our senses, to come back to ourselves, to know we can't escape it, as that was true for you.
You mentioned that idea of touch and the arousal of the body and the arousal of the nervous system. When we are doing narrative work, that comes up.
Yes.
How does one handle that?
Again, let me go back to two words, kindly, slowly. This is why you can't just see a good therapist, be in a good story group, and just tell the story, and now it's done. We know that the nature of story is such that every time we tell the story, we will have acuity to certain parts that we probably didn't have before. Certain things will literally hit us. We're telling the story, but it reverberates back in our body as we say a phrase or a word, and all of a sudden we smell, we taste, we hear, we see, we experience. And in that, most of us have a long history of when we get close to anything that bears shame, we've got a long, long history of how to annul it, to, in some sense, run from it. But the more we've got the presence of kindness, and that's what's needed for ourselves. We need kind people, not nice people, kind people who know how to step into our story and not push us. And you used that phrase before. No one forced you, but they were inviting you to step where you need to go in the next step, not 10 miles down the road, but the next step or two, to be able to take that story portion and begin to allow it to metabolize in our body, in our mind, in our heart, in a way that allows us to honor it, to take it into account, but also to meet that young 4-year-old, 8-year-old, 12-year-old boy or girl with a kindness that we have not, in one sense, experienced from ourselves, from others, and ultimately from God. So if kindness is the core, and I believe it is, the core to life, core to repentance, you have in that same passage, Romans 2, verse 4, Paul saying this next clause, why do you treat the kindness of God with contempt? So Paul's at least acknowledging none of us take kindness easily. We may be made for it and desperately desire it, but we're also terrified of it. So we're all going to step into our own story with a lot of ambivalence. We make a step or two forward. We make five steps back. We make 5 steps forward, we take 2 steps back. And it may not feel like we've made any real movement, but in one sense, that honoring of the slow, redemptive movement, truly of the word sanctification, we begin to see where we hate, where we punish, where there's cruelty to that 4-year-old or whatever age holds those particular memories. And once we begin to see, we have joined, this is a painful phrase, we have joined the kingdom of evil against our own self and body by the hatred we have exerted, the contempt we've exerted against ourselves. I think that's where there is the language of Luke 15, the story of the prodigal. And he came to his senses. I think that is such a sweet phrase. I don't know what it means for the prodigal. I know what it means for me. I've come back to myself. I've somehow stopped something of the ridiculous forms of dissociation. And I've come back to something in me saying, I want to go home. I want goodness. I don't want to continue to perpetuate something of the harm I've done to myself or I've allowed others to do to me. That's when I believe significant change begins to occur.
You make a hard differentiation between kindness and the word nice. Can you help us to understand that?
Yeah, I think niceness is a commitment to pleasantness. Look, if I'm dealing with a customer service person at the airlines that I generally book on, I really appreciate when they're nice. So I'm not going to say there's not a place for niceness, but it's usually functional to avoid conflict versus kindness is a fierce commitment to bring goodness to your very heart and life. Sometimes that fierce kindness, that fierce goodness is going to have my pushback. In fact, I guarantee it. Maybe not every moment, but a lot of moments. And in that,
you were told your health starts in your gut. But if you're a woman, it all starts in your hormones. When your hormones are off, everything is off, including digestive issues, mood, mental clarity, energy levels, weight management, and so much more. As the new year approaches, imagine hitting refresh and supporting your body with optimal hormone balance. Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormone imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance, perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this phenomenal formula, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again after years or even decades of hormone imbalances. Hormone Harmony has over 50,000 raving reviews from women from all over the world, with 98% saying they'd gladly recommend it to their friends and family. This holiday season, give yourself or the women in your life the gift of wellness. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HEALING at checkout.
Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your cachava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of cachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to kachava.com and use code SHAKE for 15% off. That's kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code SHAKE.
At the question of nice people either avoid or get nicer, kind people step into the conflict. They're not afraid of the conflict. They're able to name something of the war that's happening in your own body because they're inviting you back to what will bring you life. So in many ways, kind people offer in some sense, an intensification of the story that we want to avoid. But as you put it so well earlier, there's no pushing, there's no intrusion, there's no let's get this, tell the story so you can be done. There's always the sense this is a process at some level that will take the rest of your life. Now, on the other hand, I love what you said, that you were able to walk to the mailbox and have almost, I'm going to use different language, but almost the jaunt of a young man. Something of the freedom of, you know, you're certainly not old, but you know that there is a weariness that comes with any age. But having that sense of being, you know, mounting up like eagles, there is that notion of there is a vitality to your life that you didn't have before. You do now.
So going to throw in a few obstacles for you. People come to you and say, Dan, that happened. In my case, it was 40 some years ago. Why do I need to engage that now? That's 40 some years ago.
Well, apparently I had shoulder surgery a number of years ago and unfortunately need to have it done again. But when I asked, what's wrong? Why is my shoulder not working? And the response was, well, no apparent injury, no apparent, you know, cause, but it's just basically and they didn't use this phrase, but a defect from birth, but something that took multiple years of its ill operation to come to the surface. So the first comment is, it was Faulkner who said, the past is not the past because it's ever so present today. The reality is what occurred in harm X amount of years ago continues to play out in, at least in the metaphor of my shoulder, in its operation. It's still functioning, but not the way it was meant to be. So for us to be able to honor the past is being played out today. So you're not just dealing with something that occurred 40 years ago. You're actually addressing realities that continue to operate in your body and in this sense, in your very soul, in a way that we've got to be willing, and this is a terrible metaphor, I'm so sorry, but there has to be something almost to breaking the bone to order it in the way it was meant to be healed. So a broken bone will heal without even good care, but it won't heal the way it was meant to be. So that's at least part. The other part is, look, if you actually believe in the Bible, there's no command made more often in Scripture than this: remember the Lord your God. And its corollary, don't forget the Lord your God. And I have people say to me, well, I'm not going to forget God, but I don't have to think about my own story. And I'm like, dude, or dudette, have you ever read the freaking Bible? Because remembering God is always in the context of story. It's always in the context of our story. And what's proof of that? How often the Exodus gets mentioned. We're remembering God in the particularity of a story. And for us to escape that is to escape God. We're not just escaping our own story. We're escaping the God who looks and invites for us to be redeemed.
Another question. I'm coming to you and I say to you, I'm open to story work. I'm open to exploring, but I can't remember a lot. I remember a little bit, but I don't remember a lot.
Remember the key word you used earlier. It's the word fragmentation. So what we know about trauma is that whether it is an accident that occurred when somebody doesn't stop at a stop sign and runs into your car, the trauma of any form will always create a diminishment of our capacity in our left frontal lobe, particularly an area called Broca's area, where we manage language. So no matter if you're 4 or 40 and you suffer a significant trauma, your brain, almost in the kindness of helping you survive, will not let you hold the memory as if it were a videotape. So I would say there's no one who comes to a memory of past abuse and remembers it as it occurred, beginning, middle, and end. There will be fragments. You will have slivers, images, sensations of memory. And part of the work of story work is helping us begin to weave the particular elements into a narrative that in some sense is not an effort to prove it occurred in this particular way, but that it holds a consistency of what likely occurred and the time in which the harm indeed violated you. So if we step back, engaging a story is engaging characters. What was your father like? Tell me about him. Not necessarily in the event of the abuse, but you could describe the character. What was the setting? Because all stories have a setting, a context, and all stories occurred in literal space and time. Therefore, there's a plot. So helping us begin to hold the story as a story, again, not as made up, but as a story that allows gaps to occur, but also where you have the honor of deduction. Look, I live in the Pacific Northwest. When I got up this morning, I literally looked at the sky. I eventually looked at the weather app on my phone, but I made decisions on the basis of what the day was going to hold, what I was going to wear. So we're making deductions all day long over 1,000 different issues. Why wouldn't we allow ourselves to make deductions on the basis of our own story? I'm not saying it occurred this way. I'm saying it likely with the data has this valence, this current to have operated in a particular way. So knowing our story is not inhibited by the details we don't know, as long as we're willing to honor what we do know. And from that, be willing to be open to entering into the particular areas where we bear undoubtedly the greatest sense of betrayal, powerlessness, and in this case, shame. So as long as we understand what we're up against, then the story can evolve in a way that would not put us into a court of law and be able to say, you know, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It all occurred this way because memories don't operate like that with regard to trauma. But I do think we can begin to get a sense of what occurred and therefore engaged what our bodies would have suffered in that context.
So if we have a lot of listeners who have had a lot of trauma, and so if they want to just begin, just kind of step into one of their stories, what would you advise them to do, or how would you guide them?
Well, not that this is a resolve, but I want to make that very clear. But sometimes knowing the skeleton, knowing the infrastructure of a phenomena is really helpful to give us windows into bringing flesh to what actually occurred. So it's one of the reasons why I would recommend The Wounded Heart or Healing the Wounded Heart, two different volumes. But in addressing something of the reality of what's going on in my heart, mind, body, in my story. And you brought up Jay Stringer's work, which I think is one of the most phenomenal books I've read in, shall we say, 21st century Unwanted. Looking at the phenomena we're trying to address, sometimes we need a map. And books, they're not the journey. They're not going to do the journey for you, but they are a crucial maps to be able to step into the journey. So having that is where I would often begin with people. Just get a lay of the land to know these are phenomena that you will likely encounter. Then honoring the next step is begin to put words to even a simple phrase like, my father abused me. It may not sound like much, but you know, it's you. A simple phrase, my father abused me. My brother abused me when I was 10 in his bedroom. See, you may not feel like you've done much work, but in naming the harm, naming the character, naming the context, even naming the age, now has a kind of, there's something in the ground. You put a stake in the ground. Now, from that, what can we begin to do? And certainly I'm eventually going to say, these stories need to be engaged in a small group. They need to be engaged with a good story engager, a good therapist, a good spiritual director, somebody who's been trained in the context of reading and engaging stories. It could be a good pastor. Frankly, it could be a good plumber. I don't care who it is. But I want somebody who bears what you experienced, low, honoring engagement, kindness, invitation, no pressure. All those qualities are essential for safety to be able to enter this realm and to do so with honor. But I think some of the next steps is when you've got a stake in the ground, then even something as simple as, do you have photos of yourself when you're 4, 8, whenever, somewhere around the ages? And one of the things that a lot of clients have done is they have brought in class photos. And I remember this one person I was working with, who looked at kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade. It was a sweet, smiling, there was just something alive about this young girl, kindergarten up through third grade. Got to fourth grade, it's like she had a death face. There was no smile. There was almost a pale absence of presence. And yes, that's the context in which the abuser perpetrated the crime of abuse against her. So we can begin to get a sense of the person. And I do think there's this rich capacity of imagination when it begins to get lit up, to be able to remember, to be able to see and feel what that 8-year-old, 10-year-old might have been like, and learning to listen to them. I know that may be odd for some, but neurologically, you've got billions of cells. When we talk about your brain, those billions of cells have an almost infinite capacity to connect with other cells. So a cell doesn't just make one connection. It has the capacity for just trillions of connections. So when I say to you, there's something of a 4-year-old in you, an 8-year-old, 12-year-old, our trauma, in some sense, brings us to a crystallization of certain ages. And in that process of having to own what that 8-12-year-old might be like, I'm telling you, that 12-year-old has a voice, has a presence, has words and anger and hurt and confusion. And learning how to honor and engage that young part of us, I think, is part of the work of seeing redemption.
We're getting ready to close. I just want to have you reiterate something that I wish somebody would have reiterated to me, because when we've come from abuse, our bodies are so active and not wanting to sit for a long period of time. We want things to be over with. Could you just mention again that whole idea of how much time it takes?
Yeah, well, you have in the writings of 1 John, John saying this, when you see him, Jesus, when you see him, you will be as he is. That seems to imply to me, I've got a long way to mature. But when I see him at death or in his return, there will be a change that is beyond profound. Sanctification, that notion of becoming more like Jesus, we understand is a lifetime process. And what I would underscore is it's sort of the antithesis of American capitalism. You know, the notion of capitalism is make enough money to have money make money for you. Well, I'm sorry, that's not the issue of maturity. The nature of maturity is the more you grow, the more you see how much more you have to grow. And yet, not with pressure, not with a demand, but with privilege and gratitude. I feel the same with regard to my own story of past trauma, past harm. And that is a lot of good has occurred. I think my heart has changed. Yet, I also know there's more to be known and more to be grappled with. Frankly, more to ask the Spirit of God for healing. So in that sense, the more you grow, especially in the context of your abuse, the more there is to learn, to understand, to grieve, to be angry, to forgive. And that's a lifetime process, not finished, not done. Yet, I still want to go back to the image of you somewhat dancing on the way to your mailbox and to be able to go, that's such a beautiful picture. It's such a sweet picture of change can bring such goodness now. Imagine what it'll bring in a year from now. Instead of it being a burden like, oh, you mean I'm not done? It's more like you have the privilege of knowing more and therefore receiving more of the kindness of God, the grace of God, the sweetness of your own kindness towards yourself. So when we relieve it from the necessity to be over now, we begin to become a co-writer with God of our own story, and therefore, eventually, learning how to write with others their story. And so when we do this thing called narrative-focused trauma care in the Allender Center, our task is not to help people get done. It's to be intrigued, to be open, to honoring, to grieving, to be kind with regard to their story. And to the degree that we learn something of that process on our own behalf, I believe it's translatable then to how we engage our children, our spouses, our friends. The kindness you receive for yourself becomes the kindness you're able to give to others.
Thank you so much for the time today. I want to ask you, if people want to learn more about you, where would you lead them? Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mark, and delight to be with you. And again, so honored that you would bring your story. But if people wanted to know a bit more and look into this whole process of training and narrative-focused trauma care, which we offer to therapists, pastors, et cetera, but we actually believe plumbers, housewives, people who drive trucks, you know, physicians, lawyers, doctors, Indian chiefs, that's who we want to train. But they can look at a website called The Allender Center. .org. Sometimes spelling is an issue for people, but if you actually want to learn how to do it, it'll be available to you.
I'm really grateful for you and grateful for your work, Dan.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Kachava's all-in-one whole body shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Try their newest flavors, like the limited edition chocolate mint. With Kachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code SHAKE for 15% off.